From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on July 4th, Independence Day 2001 in Rochester. A man named Miguel Cruz was setting off fireworks with his friends on Hollister Street. Someone approached the group, pulled a gun, and shot Cruz four times. And Cruz died. It didn't take long for a suspect to emerge. Jose Joey Torres had bragged to his wife and friends that he killed Miguel Cruz. But when Torres was picked up by police, he told them he'd made up the story and all he knew was what he'd seen of the shooting on the local news. But then Torres did sign a written confession. He told police he tossed the gun in a river and police found bullets at the spot. Case closed, right? Jose Torres has been in prison in Attica for 14 years. But he has maintained that he signed a false confession, and that hasn't seemed to matter until another man in Attica for murder told Torres that he, Angel Carrasquillo, had murdered Miguel Cruz. And so now, what happens? After all, Torres confessed to the murder 14 years ago. Now another man is confessing now. Prosecutors have said they got their man. Is anyone going to listen to the new story of events? They might. This hour, we look at the nature of confessions. We ask why anyone would offer a false confession or whether Jose Torres really did confess at all. Now, especially with the murder allegation, what really happened here? We're also going to look at how the justice system works and the details in this story. My guests for the hour include Rachel Barnhart, a WROC TV anchor and reporter who broke the story. Rachel, nice to have you here. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for doing this.
Also, here's Matthew Hagan, an attorney involved here. Matthew, nice to have you as well.
Thanks for having us.
And another attorney with us here is David Abitoy. And David, nice to have you as well.
Thanks, Evan.
Rachel, let me just start with you. And many listeners are familiar with the idea of a person convicted of a murder claiming they're innocent. It was about a year ago that Adnan Syed's case became a national phenomenon with the podcast Serial. But, you know, there's a lot of people in prison who are saying, I didn't do what I was convicted of. So for you as a reporter, how did you come across the story and what made it stand out to you as potentially newsworthy?
Well, Matt Hagan contacted me, who's another guest here today. He contacted me and said that he had a client who he believed was innocent. And what caught my eye was the fact he said he had secured a written confession from another person. And that doesn't happen very often. So I started to look into what he was saying, pulling court records, that kind of thing. And it became clear to me that this is a really important story. It's not every day you have a written confession from someone else.
We're going to talk about that because I know one of the criticisms or concerns we've heard raised is, well, these are two murderers in prison. Neither one has anything to lose, et cetera. And I know that's been addressed. You've talked about that on various social media. We're going to be getting into that in this hour. But first, let's back up and let's walk through the story then, because you've worked on this story for how long before it aired? How long were you working?
I think it was August, right, that Matt first contacted me. And immediately I went to go talk to Joey Torres at Attica. We did an interview with mm-hmm. him. And I was ready to just do a story then because, again, I can't tell you how it's very important to have this written confession from Angel Carrasquillo. Matt Hagan secured a signed affidavit from him. And I thought that was really enough to just do a story on this. And I didn't really want to wait too long. But Matt suggested, well, why don't you see if Angel Carrasquillo will also do an interview with you? At the time, Angel was in solitary confinement, so I wasn't able to do an interview with him. But I waited and waited. And when he got out, we made an appointment at Attica to talk to Angel. And then he told us what he told Matt Hagan on camera. And that was a big deal. It's not every day that someone goes on camera to say they killed someone before they've even been charged with a homicide.
We've pulled some of the audio, by the way, for our listeners, and you will be hearing a bit from Angel Carrasquillo from the WROC TV News report a little bit later this hour.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Rachel.
So then I have this thing. I've got a lawyer who, you know, has this case. I've got an interview with this man who says he's innocent, and I've got an interview with a man who says he's the real killer. Well, what do you do then? And what I ended up doing was you have to take 100 steps backwards to kind of disprove your own story and find any red flags.
You look for holes in it, sure.
Right, find any connections between the individuals involved, see if there's some kind of setup here. You have to look
at... These are old friends, right? Are these old friends? Are they going
to
help
You have to
each
look
other
at everyone's motivation in the story, and Matt's motivation was pretty clear. He needed help with an appeal, And so he, you know, they're going to file what's known as a 440 motion. I'm just calling it an appeal. I know it's not technically an appeal, but they needed, you know, they had to assemble a legal team here. So you have to look at his motivation. You have to look at Joey Torres' motivation. Well, he says he's innocent. He wants to leave prison. And then you have to look at Angel Carrasquillo's motivation, which is much more complicated. And I'm sure we can talk about that. I'm not sure I'm totally familiar with it. Totally have figured him out either. But in any case, I ended up talking to several attorneys, former prosecutors in Rochester. I told them what I had. Some of them went and pulled appeal documents on their own, case files, Torres's own file, and looked through everything. And no one could find a red flag. And pretty much everyone felt that the original case against Torres was fairly weak. So I had them walk me through some of the evidence. I had them walk me through a lot of different things. And in conclusion, you know, decided that this was a pretty good story and this was very credible. And Matt Hagan, as you know, you'll hear from him, he was kind of the key to all of this because it was his investigation that led to Angel Carrasquillo and this confession.
Okay, so before I bring in the attorneys, let's walk through the details of the actual case. It's Independence Day 2001. There are plenty of people shooting off fireworks. One of them in Rochester and Holliver Streets, Miguel Cruz, and someone approaches him and shoots him four times, he dies. And at this time, Jose Joey Torres is bragging to his wife and friends that he was the guy who did that? Is that right?
Yeah, it was July 4th, 2001, and police honed in on Torres because he had been telling people he did this.
Why would you do that?
Well, at the
time, if you didn't do it.
At the time, Torres says that he was a drug addict and an alcoholic, and that he was very drunk that day. He said he told people that this because he saw it on the news. He wanted sympathy, and he told us that he also wanted money to get out of town, which really he wanted money to buy drugs.
How do you get sympathy by telling people, I'm the guy who killed that person?
Who knows?
Okay, so this is someone who's on drugs and drinking, sees a story on the news. This is his story. He sees a story on the news and decides, I'm going to tell people I'm the guy.
Yeah.
And he does.
And he did have a rap sheet. I mean, he had a number of prior arrests. So police talked to him, and I think Matt might be the best person to talk about what happened then. But they bring him in, and there were two key pieces of evidence against Torres, which prompted the jury to convict him. One was this statement, this written statement that he gave to police, and the other one was the ballistics evidence. They took him to the Driving Park Bridge where he said he threw the gun. They find three shell casings and two live rounds in the water, not the gun, but that were from a .38. .38 was the weapon used, but they could never prove that those rounds came from that gun because the gun wasn't found. They just know that they were .38.
Okay.
But what are the odds? You point into a spot in the river and
that's
just right
through the gun,
find bullets.
They find bullets.
Yeah.
Okay, so before we move on with the story, what I want to do is I want to play a clip from of Jose Torres talking to Rachel Barnhart of WROC-TV in prison on the nature of this so-called confession, and then I want to bring in Matt Hagan to talk about that. This is Torres on confessing.
I was a little bit drunk, so they said, sign these papers, and I signed the papers where they told me where the ex was, and I signed the papers, and then 45 days later, a sealed indictment comes in for second-degree murder.
Okay, so let me ask the attorney then. Matt, what happened there? What do you think, and what's your side of the story on what actually happened with that confession?
Well, what my client indicated to me, and I had an expert in false confessions, bogus confessions, look at all the evidence, and he seems to agree with my final take on what happened. But what my client advised me was, you know, he was originally picked up by these homicide investigators under the guise that they were investigating a home invasion burglary, which he did commit and which he did readily admit to. After giving a detailed confession to that burglary, the investigators told him to sign at the bottom of four blank pages and that they would run upstairs, write up the confession, and book him on a burglary charge. And they never came back.
Your claim is that he signed blank pages. He didn't knowingly sign a murder confession.
In my opinion, I don't think that's what happened. And I think if you look at the actual confession itself, the way that his signature is, it's on an angle. There are a lot of problems with the confession itself.
But he was drunk, right?
Well, A, he was drunk. So
signing on an angle isn't an indication necessarily that he signed a blank document. If he's drunk, maybe, right?
Correct. Correct. And to be fair, I don't know exactly what happened. This is what my client's telling me. I know from speaking to other witnesses that he was incredibly intoxicated to the point where he was falling down with incredibly slurred speech.
Should they be taking a confession when someone is in that state?
Absolutely not. And that's even, you know, when you look at the transcript of the hearings, when they ask the officers whether or not he was in an intoxicated condition, they absolutely deny it and say that he was not. There's family members that went in to go speak to him at the time, and they said that he could barely stand up. So whether or not he remembers it accurately or not, I don't know. But the truth of the matter is you look at the confession itself, and there are certain indications to me, as well as the expert, that it was written after the fact. And those details we'll get into at a later point. There's a lot that we can't reveal at this point for a number of reasons, because and David can get into that, you know, in a little bit, but we have evidence that it was, and the term is not a wrongful confession, because that would really be someone who knows what they're reading, number one, and is agreeing to it. The term is a bogus confession, that it actually didn't happen at all. So whether or not it was a bogus confession or wrongful confession, I think is sort of in dispute at this point. Either way, I think he was confessing or not confessing, as the case may be, to something he didn't do at all.
Okay, so that's the story as it plays out, but he gets convicted.
Correct.
He goes to prison. He's been in prison for 14 years. And Rachel, in your understanding of his conduct in prison and what he has looked to do, how did Angel Carrasquillo enter the picture?
Well, that all roads lead to Matt Hagen on this one. He got Torres's family hired Matt a couple years ago, and he just felt there was something wrong with this case. And as I told you, I had other people look at this case, and they felt that this wasn't the strongest case against Jose Torres. We call him Joey. That's what he goes by.
Joey Torres. Okay.
Yeah. So they felt this wasn't the strongest case. So Matt looked at it and felt the same way. He felt this wasn't a strong case. There were some problems here. And he started his own investigation. He found a witness who revealed the name Angel Carrasquillo. And he confronted him at Attica. And one of the keys here for me was that Angel wasn't transferred to Attica. He was only transferred to Attica like a week before Matt got his name. There wasn't an opportunity for really any jailhouse conspiracy
for Joey
here.
And Angel to know each other.
There wasn't any opportunity for the two of them to cook anything up that we're aware of. And again, Matt is the one who got Angel's name from a very reluctant witness, and then confronted him in Attica.
Okay, so, and when did that happen, Matt? When did you first talk to Angel?
Let's see.
How long ago?
I was originally contacted by the family to look into filing a 440 motion, and it wouldn't be the first time that someone from prison has maintained their innocence, whether or not it's
right,
true or not.
Mm-hmm.
It happens all the time. So I was admittedly skeptical at first as to what I was going to find. It actually, just going over my timeline last night, from the basically the day that I was contacted to the day that I actually got his signed affidavit was 1 year. So it was a year of me talking to people, witnesses, and really nothing materialized for a really long time. As essentially the sentiment that I got was that there was something wrong with the case. People always thought something was wrong with the case. But I first made contact with Angel in April of this year, 2015. About a month later in May, he provided me with a signed written affidavit confessing to the murder.
First time you talked to him? Did he tell you he did it?
He did.
He did.
The first, you know, and it was an incredibly awkward process, to be perfectly honest, because I didn't know anything about the man.
Was he in prison for, by the way?
Murder.
He's in prison for murder.
He's serving a 125-year sentence
As Rachel covered, in fact, pretty brutal murders, execution style. Yes.
Yeah, and if you look at our past scripts on this guy and past news reports, his nickname was Massacre, and he, at the age of 19 years old, made two people lie down on the ground on Avenue C to rob them at gunpoint, and shot one of them when he made a movement, and the other one ran away, chased the other one down, and shot him too, and the one who ran away survived, but the one who he shot while lying down was killed. He was charged with first-degree murder. He was convicted of first-degree murder. He was sentenced to life without parole plus 125 years for other charges at the age of 19 years old. When this Jose, when the Miguel Cruz murder happened, Angel would have been 18.
Would have been 18 years old. And in the story that Rachel reported, and in that conversation in her jailhouse interview with Angel Carrasquillo remembers his reaction when Joey Torres was convicted, and his reaction was, I got away with it. That's what he claims now, is that he thought, wow, they got the wrong guy. I got away with it. But Matt Hagen, to your knowledge, when did they first meet? Did they ever know each other? Did they have, as Rachel said in her words, you know, she looked into whether they would have time to create a scheme, hey, we're both in here for murder. You take the heat for mine. I go free. I'll find a way to do something for you. You don't see any connection, any possibility.
There's absolutely no there's no connection whatsoever until the signed affidavit comes in, because, you know, Mr. Carrasquillo was at the time that I planned on going down, which would have been in February of this year. He was being held in a prison in Dutchess County, downstate. I called to check the week before to make sure that he was still there, and he had been moved to Attica. So just randomly, really.
Okay. And so when you're talking to him, the question of motive has to come up. Why would he have been the one to kill Miguel Cruz? Tell me his answer.
It was over a drug dispute.
Drug dispute.
That was all he was willing to get into. When I first confronted him, it was incredibly awkward situation to be going, you know, number one, to Attica State Prison, which is a very intense environment, and then having a confessed, convicted killer standing right next to you or sitting right next to you, and he didn't know why I was there. I didn't advise him, and I essentially, you know, told him that who I was, why I was there, and I said, I don't want you, you know, you don't have to speak to me, but if you just hear me out. And I spoke probably for an hour before he even said a word. But he sat there and he listened to me. And at the end of that, he said, you know what, you're right. I did kill Miguel Cruz. But I want an opportunity to speak to my family before I give you a written statement. So I said, that's fine. We'll leave it at that. And then I was contacted by him and told to come back about a month later. And that's when we actually executed the affidavit. He was subsequently transferred to the same cell block that Jose Torres was on, but this wasn't until weeks or months after.
Yeah, and because you'll see both of the men in Rachel's piece talking about their interactions with each other, and Joey Torres saying he doesn't blame Angel Carrasquillo, that he's not the one to put him in prison. But the question remains on the gun. Joey Torres told police at the time that, well, he threw that gun off the Driving Park Bridge. They never found the gun, but they found spent casings and bullets essentially at the spot. And here is, let's listen to Angel Carrasquillo in Rachel's piece from WROC-TV talking about the question of the gun, because now Angel Carrasquillo is looking at this case going, well, wait a second, I'm the guy who killed him, I had the gun, and here's what he said about the gun evidence.
There's no way, only person I know what happened to that gun, what happened to them shells, is me. You know, how, they definitely didn't end up in a river, you know? Gun didn't end up in a river. So it's like, how did they get that? You know, how did they reach to that conclusion? So there's a lot of questions there in my mind.
All right, but Matthew, what then is the explanation? Just bad luck for Joey Torres that he's lying at the time and says, I threw the gun off the Driving Park Bridge, and they just happened to find 38 bullets there.
Well, I think there's a couple conclusions that can be reached. One is that he's the most unlucky person on the planet, and there just happens to be the same caliber, same amount of bullets and spent shell casings that would corroborate the story, or that somebody put them there on purpose.
Who put them there?
I think that's an excellent question. I think the people that found them are the ones that should be in a better position to answer.
Okay.
Why they found.
So you're implying that the police put them there.
If you can read into that, I think that's.
But that is a big, big allegation here. I mean, police who are not in this room to defend their own actions would tell you, we want justice. We don't want to just close a case and get it done and move on to the next. We want to get it right.
Well, if, you know, there are police officers, I think, for the most part, want to put away the people that they think are guilty. All right. When I first started my career, the idea that a police officer would take the stand and commit perjury or plant evidence or do anything of that nature was completely foreign to me. The fact is, I've seen it happen over the course of my career. I don't know enough about what happened in this case to make that allegation, but I think it raises more questions than it gives me answers.
Go ahead, Rachel.
When I was vetting this story and I was talking to former prosecutors, I said, well, how do you get around the ballistics evidence? And every single one of them said it's really easy to get around the ballistics evidence, even though that was considered some of the strongest evidence in the case. They all said, how does the gun wash away and not these bullets? And also, .38 is a common weapon. And finally, how much other stuff are you going to find in the Genesee River? How many other bullets and guns are you going to find down there? So they felt that because there was no way to match, that it actually wasn't a very strong piece of evidence. Every single one of them said that.
But it was the biggest piece of evidence in the trial besides the confession. And obviously the confession is the centerpiece, but that's outside of the confession. It's the biggest, isn't it?
I believe so. Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely. But a .38 revolver probably weighs 2 pounds. You know, you have the problem that if a gun is thrown in a river, it would have to automatically eject spent shell casings and live rounds. And then those bullets and casings are going to have to stay at the bottom while a 2 pound revolver is washed away, which I find highly unlikely.
Okay.
I'll also add this at this point, too. You know, the question of how did the bullets get there if they weren't put there by Torres, et cetera. Those are all fine questions to ask in the abstract, but it's the prosecutor's burden at the time of the trial to prove that it's Torres's bullets that are in the river there. Torres didn't say he threw bullets in the river. He said he threw a gun. And moreover, there's no evidence linking those bullets that are found in the river to the bullets from the crime scene. To the extent that the prosecutor completely failed to show that those bullets that they found in the river were the same ones used in the murder, it's not evidence of Torres's involvement in the murder. We can speculate at this point as to how the bullets got there, whether by...
You're saying there's all kinds of reasonable doubt about those bullets.
At a minimum, there's reasonable doubt. I think Rachel brings up an important point about, you know, all the garbage that you could probably find in the Genesee River if you go over the Driving Park Bridge right now. And I think, you know...
Well, why don't you guys do that, though? Go do a little sweep. Show us what you find. Give us an example.
I think the point is, we would love to do that. Here's the limitation. The government has unlimited resources to go out at the Driving Park Bridge right now if they wanted to go find this evidence. They have unlimited resources and unlimited time to charge people with murder and investigate the crimes. It's just Jose Torres. He's a drug addict. He's intoxicated. And he's not able to stand up in front of the government and do these things.
All right. So go ahead, Rachel.
I just wanted to make one point about the soundbite that you played from Angel Carrasquillo. You know, when I asked him, what did you do with the gun? That was the most he talked in the entire interview. It wasn't really a great interview. I'm not that proud of the interview I did with this guy, even though it's probably, this will never happen to me again in my career that a guy will confess on camera to something. But, you know, he was very soft-spoken, certainly not really what I expected. I don't know, you know, what someone would expect when you're in a situation like this, but he was very soft-spoken. He gave me very short answers. But when I asked him where the gun was, that was the most he spoke during the entire interview.
Okay, and he does say in the piece, I'm the one who did it. So let's listen to Joey Torres. This is a composite of some of the comments Joey Torres made in that piece on WROC-TV. The question of going home, what happened to him throughout this process, and what happens next.
I want to go home. It's time for me to go home. Judge Affronte told me, and I told him I was innocent. And he told me I will never see the streets again. He says, I'm a monster. I'm not a monster. I'm a human being. I'm not a monster. I had my past, but I'm not a monster. I'm not a monster. I don't got the heart to kill nobody. I want justice. I want justice. I want to go home and be with my family. Something I didn't do. I did 14 years for something I didn't do.
Rachel, does it matter? A lot of people have asked you online, do you believe it? Does it matter if you believe
I think what matters is that when you're doing a story like this, it has to be credible. My personal feelings don't come into play, but there has to be enough there, and it has to be credible enough that you can do a story on it. There was nothing to suggest that these people are lying. There was nothing to suggest that this was a conspiracy. There's nothing to suggest Matt Hagen is lying. There's nothing here to suggest that there's something wrong with this story. There was a lot to suggest that they're telling the truth. And that's why I did this story, and that's why we put this on the news.
Well, listeners may say, well, what would suggest they're lying is that they are murderers or that they've been convicted of murder. And at the very least, that Joey Torres was in drugs and alcohol and did have a criminal past outside of murder, and then that suggests that they might not be the most trustworthy.
That's true. Our justice system, though, isn't perfect. We know it's not perfect. We have plenty of cases here in Rochester of people who have been convicted who were, in fact, innocent and have, you know, later been freed. So that in and of itself is reason to take another look at this. But the fact remains, there is a man who signed a written affidavit and went on television news to say that he was the real killer. That doesn't happen every day. That is extremely rare. So even though you have a man who is serving life without parole, and he really doesn't have an opportunity to ever get out of prison and has, many people would say has nothing to lose. If that was the case, you'd have guys doing life terms, helping out their buddies every day by confessing to things that they didn't do. When have you ever seen that happen before?
I don't know. I don't follow the system that closely.
It doesn't happen.
Attorneys, have you seen that happen before?
I'll just add on to what Rachel said here. What we don't see are people doing life sentences, just admitting to all the unsolved crimes out there. JFK's murder, all these unsolved crimes. What we do see is police coercing false confessions from people. And at this point, now that we have the benefit of DNA evidence, we've seen false confessions play a part in 25% of cases that have been overturned by DNA evidence. So what we don't see are people, you know, in prison randomly confessing to crimes. But we do see the police getting false confessions because of the processes that they use to gain confessions.
All right, listeners, if you've got questions or comments now, we want to hear from you on this story, whether it's this case in particular or the broader issue of the way confessions happen and the system now. It's 844-295-TALK, toll free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. We're talking about a confession of a convicted murderer saying another guy in the same prison I'm in got a raw deal, that he's not the person. And Rachel Barnhart from WROC-TV broke the story. Before I get to a break, I have to ask you, Rachel, did you ever think in your own mind, I can't go on the air with this until I talk to a prosecutor and find out what's going on with this, because the prosecutors will have a lot of power in whether this moves forward, what happens next?
Well, of course, I put in phone calls and emails to the Rochester Police Department and to the Monroe County District Attorney's Office. None of them would comment on the record, but I can assure you I had many offline conversations with people, some of whom have direct knowledge of this case back in 2001, and went over it extensively with them, but none would comment on the record. And I got to tell you, I didn't expect them to for that first story, because they don't know what I'm going to report. They don't know anything about Angel Carrasquillo. They don't know anything about what I've got. Not that they called me to find out more. They didn't even do that, not even out of curiosity, to have any kind of discussion with me about it. But since then, though, the story aired 2 weeks ago, I think 2 weeks ago tomorrow. Since then, though, there's been dead silence from the district attorney's office, who doesn't have a legal obligation to really investigate anything. There's a man who's convicted. There's been no legal motion filed on his behalf in regards to this new confession. So she doesn't have a legal obligation to do anything at this point. But I think there are some legitimate questions about whether there's a moral obligation to look into this. It's not going away.
Are you disappointed you've not gotten a response?
I am, because I think that this was a pretty extraordinary story. I think it's one I'll never do again in my lifetime, and many journalists will never get a chance to do. It's so unusual to have a man, again, confess to a murder in this manner on television, and to just ignore it, I think, was very, very strange. And yes, it was disappointing.
Who was the DA at the time, Matt?
His name is Thomas Brillbeck.
He was the prosecutor, but Howard Rellin was the district attorney. This started off, Angel Carrasquillo's case actually started off as a death penalty case for that double shooting.
That's how far back we go with this case, 14 years. And And Matt, a lot of attorneys have asked me. I've tried to talk to a number of attorneys who are not involved at all with this, and there is fascination with this case. But just about every one of them says the same thing to me. Why don't you file that 440 motion right away? What are you waiting for? And if you do, then it forces the hand of prosecutors to at least get that ball moving. They don't have any obligation to respond until you do that. So what's the answer to that?
Well, part of the answer is that I'm not an appellate attorney. I'm a criminal defense attorney, trial attorney. And, you know, as David is a seasoned appellate attorney. And part of the reason I contacted Rachel Barnhart in order to get this in the press was because, frankly, I needed help. And I've been handling this case pro bono for roughly 9 months. And so in order to – it's a tough sell for most attorneys, I believe.
But you can't just I I'm not being flippant. I'm just asking a direct question. You don't know the process of just filing a 440 and just doing that? It seems like
– I do, but really, you know, David can get into it more, but you really only get one shot.
Okay.
Yeah, and so I didn't want to be the one to – I probably could have done it. I probably could have tried my best and done it, but I don't know the particulars of how to do something like that.
Never done it before?
Correct.
All right, so let's do this. We're late for a break. We're going to come back. David Abbatoy is going to tell us more about the process then, because a lot of our listeners may be interested in the single case, but I think the wider issue is justice and the way we adjudicate and what happens if something has gotten wrong and what – might happen next. We're also going to go to the phones. Keith, we'll come to you, and we've got some comments and questions coming in online if you want to join the program. We're talking about the story with the reporter who broke it, Rachel Barnhart from WROC-TV, and Matthew Hagan and David Abbatoy, our attorneys in the studio with us. More on Connection straight ahead. Coming up in our second hour, we look at a $15 minimum wage. Governor Cuomo wants a $15 minimum wage, not just for the fast food industry, but now he's saying the entire state needs to raise that wage. He says it's been too long and people are living in poverty while working full time. Should it change? What would the impact be? Join the conversation next hour right here.
Kevin McCarthy might soon be known as Speaker of the House, but back in his hometown Bakersfield, it's different.
That's one thing I'll tell you, we view him as Kevin.
Doesn't mean they're going to go easy on him.
I joke with them. I've started a new hashtag called Bring Back the Old Kevin. Not quite trending yet, but I'm working on it.
That's on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on WXXI.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Before we get to the phones, David, just briefly here. When you hear those questions pile up from sort of interested outsiders saying, all right, you're telling us a really compelling idea of a story here, and yet you haven't filed a 440, essentially you haven't started that ball rolling, why? What's the answer?
Well, the quick answer is this. The law presumes essentially that convictions are valid, and you have to have a good reason to upset one. Angel Carrasquillo's confession is a good reason, but the law also doesn't want to hear, well, I didn't do it, because the quick response from the government that you'll get is, yes, you did do it, and 12 jurors told us so. In order to get back into court, we have to say something persuasive to this judge. We have to present legal reasons, not just Angel Carrasquillo's confession, as to why there is some defect with the lower court proceedings. I guess what I'm trying to say is that in our system of justice, it's not necessarily true that innocence is enough to get you out of jail. And I think that's a major blind spot with the way our criminal justice system is, but that is the reality that we face. So in order to bring this case before the court, we have to go through every document that's been filed in this case. It's in my office right now, and it occupies two entire banker's boxes full of papers, trial transcripts, confessions, statements, Matt Hagan's extensive investigation. We have to present this all to the court in a readable form that's persuasive, that tells this story, not just of Angel Carrasquillo's confession, but the wrongfulness of the underlying conviction.
Sure. And so from what we're hearing here, again, I think the way we sum that up is you want to make sure you do it right the first time through, yes?
Absolutely.
Okay. Are you going to file sometime soon?
Absolutely.
One question that I asked David, I guess in my mind I thought, you've got this confession, it's a slam dunk, right? It's not right. A slam dunk, is it?
Not at all. Not at all. Here's the problem, and this is a problem that we face as criminal defense attorneys, it's a problem I face as an appellate attorney. I regularly hear from people saying, I'm innocent, I was wrongfully convicted, I'm here. And I'm sure judges don't want to hear that and don't like to hear that over and over again. It's not often that we have such compelling evidence of actual innocence here. We got to do this right. We got to get this in front of the judge in the right format, in the right manner, with the possibility, expecting the possibility that we might not win.
One attorney said to me, who happens to be in a different state, if they were going to move this forward and they needed help, isn't there an innocence project? Aren't there other things out there that you could contact and say, hey, this should be your poster child if we really believe in this case?
That's essentially what Matt Hagen did when he reached out to me, okay. And that's what I'm doing right now. But in the kind of grand scheme of appellate practice and putting together 440 motions, 1 week or 2 weeks of time is not a lot of time to put together, you know, complicated arguments.
All right, last question before I go to the phones. Rachel, when you hear David talk about boxes and boxes of evidence and papers and Matt's investigation and everything that went into it, you've indicated you're surprised, maybe disappointed, that the prosecutor hasn't responded to your story, that it's been almost 2 weeks, that you do have an extraordinary confession in prison. But until that motion is filed, if you're the prosecutor, they're stretched. Everybody feels like they're stretched thin in government, don't they? And then you hear David say, well, there's boxes and boxes. And if I'm a prosecutor and I've got a confession and a conviction from 14 years old, I don't have a formal motion applied to the case yet, and I'm looking at possibly boxes and tens upon tens of man hours, why respond yet?
I think it's very easy to send an investigator to Attica State Prison to sit down with Angel Carrasquillo, who agreed to take a lie detector test, by the way, and reopen this case. The things that he is saying should be extremely easy to verify. I don't see this as being, and let's just say it does take tens and tens of man hours to reinvestigate this case. It seems like it's the right thing to do. There's a man who could be innocent in prison and who's been there for 14 years. And you have another man who says that he did it. It does seem like it's in the interest of justice not to wait possibly months, because, again, it's not going. They are going to file a 440 motion. This isn't going away. To get in front of it and just start the investigation now. It's not hard to do. Just get on the road and go talk to Angel.
Okay, let me get to the phones. And Keith is first up. Go ahead, Keith.
Yes, good afternoon. I was kind of interested. Some of the statements that have been made, and one of the things that I guess one of your guests did speak to was the issue about the weapon itself. A 38 was a common weapon, but was really first thing that came to my mind is, well, how could they find shells but not find the weapon? Because the weapon being heavier, how would it have been washed down the river? But the shell casings were found, which is very peculiar to me. But I think what was also very interesting is, I think what you're doing with the work that they're doing is very important, because through the Innocence Project and other things that have happened across the country, we know that district attorneys and along with the help of law enforcement have, whether here locally or nationally, I've read many stories and had collected quite a few of them where law enforcement had coerced confessions or out of individuals, not just minorities, but in the South, or had taken false confessions from individuals, and if the accused did not do so, they threatened certain actions against their family. You know, certain things would be done against their family if they didn't confess to these particular crimes. So this particular case, in my opinion, should not be dismissed so easily, but should be given all the consideration that it is being given now, because if this individual has been incarcerated for over a decade for something that he did not commit, then every effort and every party that can help this individual should be a part of it, and it should not be just flippantly dismissed as, well, this is just another guy lying because he had a pass. Well, many of us have passed. We may not have gone to jail or maybe we didn't do drugs, but, you know, many of us have things that we have done in our lives that we're not proud of, but doesn't mean that we should not be given the opportunity for justice because of a colorful past.
Keith, thanks for the phone call. Some response from the guest. I'll start with Matt Hagen. What do you think, Matt?
I agree completely with what he's saying. And, you know, just briefly on the various organizations that do provide assistance, I did reach out to the Innocence Project. Unfortunately, the Innocence Project only handles cases that have DNA evidence. So they, you know, basically told me that up front. They referred me to a program out of the University of Chicago Law School called the Exoneration Project. I spoke to them, and they were incredibly helpful, but also incredibly overwhelmed, which I think you mentioned the larger picture here. Most of the not-for-profit organizations or the people that are designed to help in these types of situations are incredibly bogged down, and you know, they get probably hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of letters per year from people indicating that they're innocent. So in order for someone to actually take interest in a case, I think is difficult, very difficult.
Let me read a couple of comments that have come in online. On Twitter, Chris writes, the idea, I think, that prompted Chris's comment on Twitter is that we have seen people go to prison for crimes they didn't commit. Chris says, quote, "We've also seen slimy lawyers facilitate acquittals of guilty, dangerous people who should not be entitled to freedom." David?
I'd be happy to respond to that. You know, I think we're at kind of a watershed moment in criminal justice right now. And the advent of two technological advances has shown us kind of a dirty underbelly of the criminal justice system and how convictions are gotten. Those two technological advances are DNA and cameras on cell phones. And in the last 10 years, we've seen people who allegedly admitted to crimes exonerated by DNA evidence, and we've seen police officers lie over and over in attempts to put people in jail and have been proven to be lying by videotaped evidence of those things. Criminal defense attorneys are doing their job, and the job is to put the government to its proof. When that proof is tainted by difficulties with truth-telling, it's the public's duty to acquit people. It's the public's duty to cry out when innocent people are in jail, because our justice system is founded on the precept that innocent people shouldn't be in jail.
On the question of police behavior, Scott emails the program and says that he is offended at the notion that police might have done something wrong. Can you at least wait until you have any evidence that they did that before you slander them? So Scott is saying, hey, you are alleging that police could have planted evidence. And Matt, he's saying you've got no evidence of that, and that's a big leap.
Well, first of all, I don't think I came out and said that the police planted evidence. I said somebody put it there. Who, if you want to jump to the conclusion that it was the police, that's fine. But the fact of the matter is you have an individual who admits to killing. He has knowledge of forensic evidence that only the killer would know. He has knowledge, and there's independent eyewitnesses that can verify or corroborate his story, which I will release at the appropriate time. And he tells us the gun didn't end up in the river. So the fact that RPD says that we're going to look in this exact spot where we think the gun is and then come up with the exact caliber of shell and the exact number of spent shells that should have been there, I think, is either the biggest coincidence in the world or they were deliberately placed there. And that's not a question I can answer. I was still in law school at the time this occurred.
How many bullets and shells did they find?
They found 3 spent shell cases and 2 live rounds.
Which is what?
I believe there were 4 shots that were fired, okay. So maybe there was 1 spent shell that they couldn't find. But, you know, that's really, you know, I spoke to Rachel at length. You know, I've been investigating this case for 1.5 years. And I probably have more questions at this point than I do answers.
But
you know, and a lot of, and people have to, if they have a good reason for why it's there and it's not a coincidence, then that's fine.
But let's be clear about something. Jose Torres is innocent of this crime, regardless of what the police may or may not have done. And we know that because we know Angel Carrasquillo's has a credible confession to this crime. And we know that the evidence linking Jose Torres to the crime is not credible. For example, the people who initially saw the shooter said he was black. Take a look at Rachel Barnhart's story and the video of it. Jose Torres is not black, and nobody would mistake him for a black person. Jose Torres said he threw the gun in the river, not shell casings. So that's just not true. And the shell casings that the police found don't link Jose Torres to the shooting. So even if you assume that everything's above board with regard to how these shell casings got into the river, they still do not tie Jose Torres to the shooting.
There's also the mask on Jose Torres' confession. He said he wasn't wearing a mask, and witnesses said the shooter was wearing a mask.
Does Jose Torres have a credible alibi for where he was that day, Rachel?
I don't know. Does he?
He does.
He does?
He does. He was at a family barbecue for the 4th of July around numerous family members for pretty much the entire day and entire night.
The other thing
which was never explored.
Yeah, and Jose Torres' confession is a little strange. It's like I went to Darien Lake bungee jumping with my friend Julio, and then I got back to Rochester and got in an argument with someone at a gas station and later decided to kill him. But Angel's confession is, no, this guy robbed me of some money and drugs. I put on a mask and walked up and shot him. I mean, which one sounds more reasonable to you?
What we know after seeing these DNA exonerations and reading the false confessions that go along with them is that the false confessions have these elements in them that Rachel's talking to us about. There's these things that just don't quite fit. And then when you kind of see the real story, then it kind of opens your eyes and you say, well, that makes a little bit more sense here. Even the interrogator who took Jose Torres's testimony admitted under oath that he gave Jose Torres information about the crime that he didn't already know. For example, the number of shots that were fired to kill Miguel Cruz. The interrogator told Jose Torres that it was 4 shots. And lo and behold, the 4-shot evidence ends up in the confession, and we all find it to be credible.
Dave on Twitter says, at least still thankfully, he says, this comment seems weak, but still, at least thankfully, we don't have the death penalty in New York State. That's from Dave, who's listening on Twitter. Rachel, you want to weigh in? Go ahead, Rachel.
Well, someone just tweeted me saying that, you know, Monroe County, the district attorney's office, lacks a conviction integrity unit. And that's something that some offices, I believe, in New York City are starting to implement that would have an office already to look at something like this when it comes up.
Okay. Is that something attorneys, David, you know, does that exist elsewhere? And should that happen here?
It does exist elsewhere. And I think that we've learned there are many concerns that are revealed almost on a monthly basis that people are being exonerated by DNA evidence. I think there needs to be, not just by district attorney's offices, but by the legislature itself and everyone involved in the criminal justice system to look at how these wrongful convictions occur and how we can improve how we do things.
We have a few minutes left, and we've got a number of listeners emailing who are kind of hung up on the question, well, but this guy confessed. You've got Joey Torres.
Which one?
I understand what you're saying, David, but our listeners are saying 2001, Joey Torres tells his wife and his friends he committed this murder. Police pick him up. He signs a confession. And a lot of listeners are saying, I don't get it. Explain it better to me. Go ahead, Matt.
I don't mean to cut you off, but the idea that he bragged to other witnesses and that he confessed to other witnesses, including his wife, who overdosed on drugs a month after he was arrested and passed away, who was the original person who originated the investigation and call and contacted police. A number of these witnesses were federal probationers at the time. And the investigator on this case was investigated in 2012 for specifically misconduct in relation to federal probationers. So I think that is something that needs to be explored. And the other thing I wanted to mention is that, you know, Rachel's a veteran reporter. My co-counsel here, David, is a seasoned veteran practicing 12 plus years. I've been practicing law for 10 years. I was in law enforcement prior to that. This wouldn't be the first time that somebody, you know, people have lied to us or we're not unfamiliar with that concept. I wouldn't be sitting here if I didn't believe in my heart of hearts that this man is sitting in prison and that he's innocent of what he's convicted of.
Okay, we got about 90 seconds left. Briefly to tie up a few loose ends, David, timeline for a 440 motion is when?
We're looking at, you know, maybe over a month. But that's just
soon.
Because there's so much paperwork to
All right.
be
So
reviewed.
That'll be soon. And I want to stress to our listeners, you know, absolutely the district attorney's office should have every opportunity to talk about this if they choose, We reached out to them. They did not have all that much time to get back to us for today's program. They're busy. I have no problem with that. Rachel has been reaching out to them for a much longer time. And again, if you missed it, Rachel said you've heard nothing from the DA's office.
No. And I just want to point out, I mean, Matt is a little bit more of a skeptic about police and a little bit more of a conspiracy guy when it comes to evidence. And I think, you know, they're defense attorneys. I wasn't able to find any indication that anyone did anything nefarious back in 2001. That doesn't mean it didn't happen, though. But I just wanted to point that out as part of, you know, what I looked into.
All right. So 20 seconds, Rachel. What do you do next in this story as the reporter?
Well, I think we have to just keep following it. And I mean, Sandy Dorley is going to be at a press conference. I'll be at 2 p.m. And, you know, maybe today's the day I'll be able to finally see her, put a microphone in front of her and say, what are you doing about this? And see what she has to say. I mean, she's clearly aware of it. But I mean, we'll continue to follow this. And the fact that the guy went on the TV, the fact that Angel went on television and confessed, lends an accountability factor to this story that many things don't have.
Okay. And 20 seconds, David, and we're in tight for time. What do you want the system to do to change? Give us one actionable item that you think would make the justice system better at finding justice.
It probably stopped the strong reliance on eyewitness identification testimony. I think we'll look back on this as a mistake 20, 30 years from now as we learn more about it.
All right, let's stay in touch on this story. Thanks to Rachel Barnhart from WROC-TV for coming in and sharing what she's been reporting with our listeners today. Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you.
Also, thanks to attorneys in the studio, Matt Hagen and David Abitoy, and certainly stay in touch with you gentlemen as well. Thank you, David.
Thank you, Evan.
Thank you, Matt.
Thank you, Evan.
Short break, and we're talking a $15 minimum wage for New York State next hour.